Welcome to the Birthful Podcast. I'm Adriana Lozada, and today we'll be talking about cannabis use during pregnancy and breastfeeding. With legalization of cannabis around the world expanding, it's time to have a nuanced conversation. What do we know about health risks? What about legal risks? Is a non-biased risk-benefit analysis centered on harm reduction possible? And what would that look like? Heather Thompson has answers. Stay tuned. This episode of Birthful is brought to you by Derma-E, proud to be one of the top clean beauty brands with a long-standing commitment to high eco-ethical standards. Go to Derma-E.com and use the promo code BIRTHFUL20 to get 20% off your entire purchase. This episode of Birthful is also brought to you by Ember Wave, the first bracelet that helps you feel colder or warmer at the press of a button. Get $50 off for the holidays by going to emberwave.com/birthful. The Birthful Podcast, talking to maternity pros and new parents to inform your intuition. Hello, hello, mighty parents and parents-to-be. Happy holidays and happy end of the year. And in fact, the decade. I cannot believe we are about to enter a new decade. Thank you so very much for making this year a wonderful year with all the love you give the show. And for all your messages about how Birthful was a big part of your pregnancy, I really love them. If what you hear is helpful, make sure you subscribe so you don't miss a thing. You can support this podcast by supporting its sponsors, which in this week's case are Derma-E and Amber Wave. You can also become an official Birthful patron at patreon.com/birthful. And as a thank you, patrons get access to extra content for each episode, as well as access to ad-free episodes. As we wrap up the year, I want to give a special, enormous, gigantic shout out to Megan Othling for her amazing and long-lasting Patreon support. Megan is a fabulous birth doula, childbirth educator, and prenatal and postpartum exercise specialist in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And if you live near there, do connect with her. You can learn more at womenofvalorbirth.com. All right, so piggybacking on all of these end-of-year celebrations, we are also celebrating the fact that the podcast is 5 years old, and we're going to do that with a month-long bash throughout January. All the details will be announced tomorrow, Thursday, December 26th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, and I'm going to be doing that through a Facebook Live on the Birthful Facebook page. Right off the bat, I'm going to do giveaways among the people who join me for that first announcement, and that's going to set the tone for the celebration because I will be doing a Facebook Live with giveaways every Thursday through the month of January. And we're also going to have some giveaways on Instagram. And on top of all that, I'm also going to be talking with some of your favorite guests for those events. So do come join us. The place to go is facebook.com/birthful to get all the details. All right, so onward to today's episode. You may be aware that cannabis is fully legal in Canada and in over a fifth of the United States, as well as it being decriminalized in a growing number of places. But legality does not equal safety. Heather Thompson is here for a nuanced conversation on the complex topic of cannabis use during pregnancy and breastfeeding. And whatever your thoughts may already be on this topic, what thoughts you might have on this topic, set aside your biases so you can dive deeply with us in considering things that you may not have thought of before. I know I learned a lot during this conversation and in preparation for the episode. So here we go. Welcome, Heather. I am so delighted to have you here on the podcast today.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah. And we had the good fortune, and I would say to me, it's a good fortune that we were able to connect face to face this year at the Evidence-Based Birth Conference. And that was definitely so good to put a face to a person that I already had so much respect for.
Hear, hear. Online world is lovely for us learning to know each other. And it's always great to see people in person.
Mm-hmm. And so this is the topic that you've been immersed in for quite a few years now, and that's been coming up more and more lately. So I was delighted as well when you suggested that we talk about this. It's the use of cannabis in pregnancy and postpartum, related to breastfeeding, and that's like a big topic. So I want, and that I am not very familiar with at all. So I want you to definitely lead the conversation. Like, what needs to be considered when having this discussion?
Yeah. Well, let me just give you a little bit of background too, and sort of how I came to talk about this. I have a PhD in molecular and cellular biology. So I am trained as a scientist, did basic science for many years. And when cannabis became legal here in my home state of Colorado, I was working as the director of research at a community midwife-led freestanding birth center. And so I was already deeply immersed in the birth world. And I, at that point, had been a postpartum doula for, I don't know, 10 or so years. It's been about 17 years of postpartum doula work for me. So I also had been at people's bedsides, literally, as they were navigating the questions around cannabis even before it was legal. Once it became legal, I had doctors and midwives and nurses and lactation folks reaching out to me to say, what do you know from the scientific literature? We're having to answer a whole new host of questions. So I really got drawn into the conversation. It wasn't necessarily a conversation that I sought out initially. And I have found in talking about cannabis and advocating for folks who choose cannabis as medicine here in Colorado, I have grown quite passionate about advocating for parental autonomy and agency when it comes to this conversation, and really rooting this conversation in a risk-benefit harm reduction place rather than one that is abstinence-based or really punitive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so 17 years as a doula, and then that launched you into this these questions. You also this past year co-authored or participated in a paper relating to breastfeeding and cannabis use.
Yes.
And you mentioned, as I was like, I went deep in your website and like downloaded, you have so many great resources and PDFs there. And I was reading them all. I was like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. Yes. But you said, you know, you had learned a lot through the writing this process and helping families navigate the families that encounter CPS because of cannabis use since 2014, and you've learned so much. So how do you want us to like jump into this conversation? Do you want to go like prenatal, pregnancy, this is what we need to know, and breastfeeding, this is what we need to know, or does it all mesh together and going from your experiences?
Well, you know, let's start with the question I get asked the most, which is perinatal cannabis use safe? Everybody wants to know that. And it's funny, people say, just give me the lowdown, the skinny, the two-sentence answer, is it safe or not? So I will start this conversation by saying that I don't use the word safe to describe cannabis use. I think there are very few things that are actually safe, either in pregnancy or lactation or life in general. And I think that when we're talking about what people do with their lives during pregnancy and lactation, we really need to have a risk-benefit conversation. You know, we know driving while pregnant is not actually a safe activity. And we use seatbelts and tell people to be careful and be cautious and understand that driving has to be a part of their life. And so I don't use the word safe, but what I can tell you from the scientific literature and what we know right now is that we have been studying cannabis use during pregnancy for a pretty long time in the U.S., a little over 30 years. We started, there was a research project started in inner city Pittsburgh in the 80s that followed a group of people up until the current day and have been describing outcomes of the kids. What I will say about that data set, however, is that the initial reason for the study was to examine the crack epidemic, which was happening in inner city there. And we have subsequently learned that the idea of a crack baby, you know, that a baby is damaged by exposure to cocaine, in utero has turned out to be a false narrative. There really is no single way to describe the outcomes associated with cocaine use. And what we know is that if a kiddo grows up in a environment that is healthy for childhood development, then the exposure to cocaine is not detectable throughout their lifetime. So I want to root the science itself even in the perspective of what we were looking at that time. The perspective was one of believing exposure to substances was harmful. This was funded by, is continued to be funded by the National Institutes of Drug Abuse. And so there is a certain perspective that even goes into the research. So what we have found most reliably, there's also a study in Canada, there's a long-term study in the Netherlands, and consistently the outcome we see most often with heavy cannabis use, and I want to be really clear about this part, we're not really looking at outcomes related to occasional or periodic cannabis use. We're really looking at folks who use cannabis on a daily or near daily routine throughout the majority of their pregnancy. And what we can see is some small for gestational age or low birth weight babies. Occasionally we see outcomes related to preterm birth. And, you know, none of those are super surprising. The majority of folks that I encounter and the research describes are smoking cannabis flower. So anything that you smoke is going to have a potential risk of, you know, blood flow changes and potential increased risk of low birth weight. So that is really the most consistent outcome that we see throughout all the literature. That being said, in and of itself, low birth weight, small for gestational age, preterm birth do not have to be necessarily bad outcomes in and of themselves. They always have to be evaluated in the context of the environment. What else is going on in this family's life? Was there an overlay of poverty? Do we have lots of stress? Is there trauma? You know, what is the context of the impact of prenatal cannabis use?
Mm-hmm. And there was, you just, let's unpack all of that for a little bit.
Yeah.
Because there was so much there. So in terms, it's important to, what I heard was it is important to figure out, to differentiate between occasional use and more of a chronic use.
Exactly.
That there is a, we have to pay attention that we're not doing, that correlation isn't causation. So
correct.
That just because somebody with a daily use, the research is showing that may have a higher risk for low birth weight or small for gestational age or preterm baby, it doesn't mean that it's because of that daily use. There can be other things that influence that, whether it's what else is the context of their lives in terms of poverty and stress and other factors.
Exactly. Perfect summary. Exactly right.
Excellent. And that also, all the things that, like, nothing that we do in our lives is safe. There's always a risk to something.
Yes.
So viewing it from that, and that we also have to kind of check our biases at the door from what you were saying of, for example, that these studies were looking specifically trying to determine the idea of a crack baby and what that looks like, and understanding that there isn't really any specific causation between substance abuse and these, what people describe as crack babies.
Exactly.
Okay.
And, you know, I mean, and taking one step further, in fact, the substances that show the most consistent harm when used prenatally are cigarettes and alcohol. So the idea that the illicit drugs are, quote unquote, the harder drugs and therefore cause more harm is not actually based in research.
And that also, as I was reading, it led me to, you know, the great point that legalization doesn't equate safety at all, because of what you just said about alcohol, caffeine, cigarettes being causing harm even though they're illegal, or having the potential to cause harm even though they're illegal, but seeing it both ways, that also the legalization of cannabis doesn't equal safety at the same time.
Exactly. And I would offer that we didn't criminalize cannabis because we thought it was unsafe either. I mean, cannabis at one point was part of our U.S. pharmacopoeia here until the early 1940s. It was actually sold in pharmacies and used usually in tincture form for all the things you'd imagine: to improve mood, to reduce nausea, to help with menstrual cramps, the sorts of things you hear about it being used now. So it was not made illegal because we were worried that it was unsafe either. It was made illegal for political and racist reasons.
And let's put that on the shelf for a bit. I don't want to go down that rabbit hole just yet. Maybe if we have time at the end, we'll step into that.
Right.
Because there's so much thoughts that come with that to my mind.
Totally.
In terms of like other things that we use in the pharmacopedia, including like, you know, cocaine and arsenic, which we know are so harmful. I'm not trying to equate, but so considering the biases, considering all the groundwork that you just laid out, What do we know in terms of prenatal exposure concretely? Or do we know anything concretely in terms of prenatal exposure?
Well, concrete is a very concrete word. Mm. I mean, I think that the evidence points to chronic use, like I said, can increase the risk for low birth weight, for gestational age. There is some evidence that suggests that prenatal cannabis use increases the risk for NICU admission. I struggle with NICU admission as a good marker of newborn health outcomes, because in my experience, particularly in the context of prenatal substance use, if someone is suspected to be known to use substances prenatally, their baby may most likely will have a higher chance of going to the NICU just because the labor and delivery staff know that. It's not necessarily a health risk per se. So I don't talk so much about the NICU admission piece, even though that is another consistent element of the scientific literature. So from my view, those are the things we know most concretely. The other pieces that go into public health messaging, particularly here in Colorado, are the concept that prenatal cannabis use will result in cognitive or achievement deficits in elementary school, middle school, and high school aged kids. And I would offer that that is a real link that is lacking in very much nuance. The data that show that are for the most part derived from this study in the US, where 60% of the folks were African American mothers living singly and raising kids on their own and living in poverty. And we know for sure that poverty can cause academic achievement issues in kiddos when they reach school age. And to correlate it with cannabis and to be as forceful as some of the public health messaging that I've seen, I don't think that link is nearly as clear as we think it is. I'm not saying it might not be shown to be true. I, as a person who reads the scientific literature, though, feel pretty frustrated with the idea that that is a clear result of prenatal cannabis use. And it also frustrates me because the idea of cognitive achievement in kiddos is such a complex one with so many things that impact that, both prenatally and throughout their lifetimes. And I wish we were unpacking the other factors that are usually involved in the research that suggests that there's cognitive achievements. And I wish we talked about alcohol, cigarettes, and caffeine, all of which have also been shown to have potential impacts on kiddos when they get to school age and their ability to learn. But we really don't shame folks with that fact in the same way that we are about cannabis right now.
Well, and I think the shame is a huge part of this conversation that I really want to get deeper into, because it ties into also biases and contained with the public health messages and the legal risks. And like, there's a bigger flip side to this than just what we know because of the context societally that we put into that knowing, right? And people wanted to report. So let's take a quick break and we'll come right back to that. I am loving my Derma E products, and so is my skin. I enjoy using the products because I love their subtle floral scents, and I continue to use their products because I see results and because I know that Derma E products do not contain any yucky stuff. Whether your issue is aging, acne, dry, oily, or sensitive skin, Derma E has a proven clean beauty solution for everyone. If you're looking to rejuvenate your skin and even your skin tone, then you should try Derma E's Vitamin C line that brightens and supports collagen health. The unique stabilized form of vitamin C used in their products is less likely to degrade before being absorbed by the skin, so your skin gets more benefits. And as with all Derma E products, this line of products is paraben-free, vegan, gluten-free, soy-free, and cruelty-free. Right now, Derma E has a great offer for my listeners. To get you started on trying their clean beauty solutions, they are giving you 20% off any products on their website with promo code BIRTHFUL20. Get 20% off your entire purchase today. Go to DermaE.com and use promo code BIRTHFUL20 to get 20% off your purchase now. That's DermaE.com with the code BIRTHFUL20. And we are back talking with Heather Thompson about the effects of, or just the general discussion about cannabis use in, during pregnancy and breastfeeding, what we know and what we need to consider. So in those things that we need to consider, we took a look at the health risks, but we can't have that conversation without legal risks, which are also imbued in that stem from the idea of shame and a lot of bias.
Yes, for sure. I mean, that would be, this is feeding right into what my next topic would have been, was we talk a lot about the health risks. Most public messaging that I've seen is center on the health risks. And very few folks are giving families clear information on the potential legal and child welfare risks, which can be significant. For example, here in Colorado, we have a law that says a baby who tests positive for exposure to a Schedule 1 or a Schedule 2 substance, unless it's prescribed by a physician, is an automatic finding of child abuse and neglect. Well, cannabis is a Schedule 1 substance. And even though we legalized it in the state of Colorado, that law that describes child abuse and neglect has still been in effect. So folks were disclosing their cannabis use to their perinatal healthcare providers because it was legal, and they were thinking they were doing a good job by disclosing this piece that they otherwise might have held closer to their secret side. And then they're finding that, in fact, they're being charged with child abuse and neglect here in the state of Colorado. And charged isn't exactly the right word, because it's not a criminal charge, but it's a finding. It means that you're name goes on a database as someone who has abused and neglected your child, and it does prohibit you from certain jobs. It prohibits you from certain public housing. It can even prohibit you from certain public benefit systems. So it's a very serious situation and something that most folks have no idea might be coming. And that was the other way that Elephant Circle really stepped into this conversation. My colleague and the founder of Elephant Circle, Indra Lucero, is a lawyer. And so around the time I was getting scientific questions, Indra was fielding questions from folks who'd gotten a letter in the mail saying that they had been founded to child abuse and neglect their child because of prenatal cannabis use. And some folks really hadn't even had a conversation with anybody about it. There hadn't been an investigation. It was just a result of this law. So we really started to try to educate folks. We became a place where people could call when they discovered at some point that their perinatal cannabis use might pose child welfare or legal risks. And not being a lawyer or someone who has been exposed to child welfare prior to the last 5 years, I have learned a lot about the role of child welfare in this conversation and the way that child welfare does not operate from a harm reduction point of view, and that my demographic, white, owning class, U.S. citizen, English-speaking folks, don't have very much community experience with child welfare, and we think the best of a system that sometimes actually is quite punitive and hard to navigate.
And so tell me more about that, of your experiences, because, and what you've learned, because from what I understand, in terms of if caregivers, health caregivers have sort of a responsibility, or I think it's a legal requirement yeah. that if somebody comes up to them and tells them that they use cannabis, they have to disclose that. But is that only to states where it is illegal, or are you finding that in Colorado as well? What do you know?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So in some ways, when cannabis was illegal, it made that question a little bit different. I think that if providers felt that the illegal cannabis use was problematic, it was very easy to report that and step into their mandatory reporter shoes. I will say that legalizing and liberalizing cannabis in Colorado has really forced providers to wrestle with their mandatory reporter status in a way I don't think anybody was quite prepared for. Technically and legally, providers are only supposed to report, in the state of Colorado, are only supposed to report cannabis use if they think it also coincides with child abuse and neglect. The problem is that most healthcare providers don't necessarily feel trained in sussing out what abuse and neglect might look like. And in the case of somebody walking into a hospital, giving birth and being discharged in, 24 to 72 hours, there's not really a relationship between those providers and that patient to be able to even make such determinations. So in my experience, providers often will err on what they think is the safe side by reporting somebody's use. And I've also found that there's lots of providers who are unaware of what that report then turns into, what might happen as a result of that report. And often providers will think that resources for treatment or recovery, particularly if they're worried that somebody really is abusing cannabis, are going to be available as a part of that response to that report. And that specifically is not often how it is. Not only because those resources simply don't exist, but they don't really exist in the context of the child welfare system in a way that really promotes long-term recovery. So I have a lot of compassion for healthcare providers and how they're navigating it, which is one of the reasons this sort of black and white law that we have in Colorado about a toxicology test at birth makes that toxicology test so appealing, because then providers, it's just a simple line, the baby tested positive or not. And if they did test positive, you are supposed to report. And and I think then that test becomes a way to mitigate some of the larger anxiety about trying to evaluate somebody's parenting skills. And what we know is that lots of folks can use substances and parent successfully, and there are folks who don't parent successfully with or without substances. So it really is a hard thing to evaluate when folks are thinking about sending a baby home with a family they don't even know.
And then that brings us also a little bit into the question of the idea that just because that substance was found in the baby's body doesn't mean that it's always in the baby's body. Because, well, right? Go, you explain it better than I can.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's the, so umbilical cord testing, which is becoming increasingly common, can test exposure back to 20 weeks of pregnancy. So it doesn't give you any information about when or how much or what timing or what reason that person might have used cannabis. And what we test for in whether we're testing the baby's blood, the mom's urine, the baby's urine, is not THC, even though that's how we talk about it. It's actually a metabolite of THC. So THC, tetrahydro, I'm not going to say the long name right here, gets broken down into carboxy THC in the body. And that metabolite is actually what we test for. And that metabolite remains in the body for a long time after exposure, sometimes a few days, sometimes a few weeks. For somebody who uses cannabis regularly, it can actually be several weeks that that metabolite can remain in the body. So I am a molecular biologist, and it bothers me that we don't talk about the right molecules. And most of the public health messaging that I see centers on THC. I hear healthcare providers say that babies are testing positive for THC. And when they say that, they often think that the babies are stoned at that moment, because we know that THC is the psychoactive molecule. But the molecule we test for, carboxy THC, is not psychoactive. So even though it hangs around in the body, that baby is not experiencing psychoactive properties throughout that entire time. So to talk about it, that we test parents for THC or we test babies for THC, bothers me, because it gives us a different view of what that person is experiencing. We're actually testing for a metabolite that remains in the body long after the THC is gone.
Well, and if you're saying that if you do an umbilical cord testing and that can show exposure back to 20 weeks of pregnancy, that's like, you know, up to could be 20 weeks back, roughly.
Yes.
That's a lot. So that means that at any point, regardless of how often, like, that person could have had one, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, instance of using the substance 20 weeks before. And then at that point, I mean, I hear what you're saying, that it is really hard to extrapolate what the usage and risk is from just getting a test that says, yes, there's this metabolite here.
Yeah, I mean, it's the difference between exposure and the outcomes related to the substance use itself, which is one of the trickiest parts of this conversation. We really, right now in our culture, like to hold pregnant folks responsible for the environment of their bodies, and as though they are existing in a vacuum. And, you know, the idea, we call them here in Colorado substance exposed newborns. It's not simply the exposure to a substance that might have harm. It's actually, I mean, child abuse and neglect should be based on the parent's use and how that affects their ability to parent, not that they used and that their baby was exposed to it. Because we don't have any data to show that there's a direct relationship between exposure and abuse and neglect. In fact, we have lots of data to suggest that that is not the case. There's a great study in Jamaica where ganja is enculturated in a different sort of way, and the group of people who use it regularly also tend to sell it, and so are of higher economic class than folks who don't use it as regularly. And what they found was that the babies who were exposed to cannabis in utero and through breastfeeding actually did better simply because their perinatal environment was better. So to myopically look at what's happening in the uterus and to hold that individual responsible for all the things that the fetus experiences through their uterus, forgets that that person lives in an environment of whatever they're experiencing, whether it be poverty, whether it be wealth, whether it be a super stressful job, whether it be they get to eat organic food every day. But I get frustrated with the conversation and how we focus on exposure, because it pretends that the pregnant person exists in and then exists outside of an environment in and of themselves. And I wish we supported pregnant people in order to help them support their growing lives inside of them. I wish we supported postpartum people so that they could then support their newborns and their children. But we really like to separate babies and children, babies from their parents, in both a physiologic and sort of a legal child welfare point of view.
And in terms of the environment, this is such a great, like, if you look at the Environmental Working Group, they have a great research where they took they tested the umbilical cord blood of, I don't remember the data set, but quite a number of babies. And they found so many different chemicals that have been even banned in the US for decades, but they're so pervasive that they stick around in the environment and you're exposed to them, and then they go to the uterus, so, and to the baby. So it's that rationale of just because it's there, therefore you are neglecting your child. I understand completely how that is just such an enormous unfair leap. And so you had mentioned at the beginning of the talk that what you would like to see is to have this conversation centered around parental autonomy, and that you would wish those were the changes. So let's take another break, but when we come back, let's talk about a little bit of that. Like, what do pregnant people and new parents need to consider in terms of that health risks benefit conversation, and also what they need to know from the system, because it's an imperfect system, to navigate it, to be able to make their own informed choices that are right for them within their parental right. We will be right back. If you've been thinking about getting an Ember Wave bracelet but aren't sure if it actually works, I can testify that indeed it does. And it's not just me. On their website, they have hundreds of verified reviews from people that are using the Ember Wave bracelet for warming, for cooling, for help with sleep, stress, and even with hot flashes. As you know, pregnancy and postpartum are times of great and sudden temperature fluctuations. And because temperature is so personal, everyone around you might be fine with it, or it may not be feasible for you to adjust the room temperature. That's where the Ember Wave can be a game changer. It lets you take your comfort into your own hands. Here is how it works. All you do is press the button to activate Ember Wave for a burst of heating or cooling. Similarly to running your hands under cold water or cupping them around a hot drink, the heating or cooling sensation created by the Ember Wave pairs with your body and mind to make you feel more comfortable in a matter of minutes. The Ember Wave has several settings, including a fall asleep mode, that can help you maintain a comfortable temperature as you drift off to sleep. Ember Wave was invented by three MIT scientists and was named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of 2018. It is really an amazing bracelet. Seriously, you should go check it out. They even have a 30-day guarantee. Birthful listeners can get $50 off for the holidays by going to emberwave.com/birthful right now. The Ember, though, is spelled E-M-B-R, so go to emberwave.com/birthful for $50 off your order. emberwave.com/birthful. And we are back talking with Heather Thompson. And so, Heather, so what do people need to know in terms of trying to make that informed decision of whether using cannabis during pregnancy or breastfeeding is something that they want to consider or not?
I really try to talk folks through a risk-benefit analysis that is centered in harm reduction. So, I often have people call me at some point during pregnancy. I've talked to somebody in labor. I've talked to folks right after pregnancy during breastfeeding. And when they call and they're trying to evaluate their own cannabis use. And I will also preface this by saying I've talked to many, many, many families in the past 5 years. And the majority of people who are using cannabis during pregnancy and lactation are using it as medicine and using it thoughtfully and carefully. I want to push back a little bit against the narrative that now that cannabis is more liberalized, everybody is using it. I think use has probably increased, particularly in the younger age groups. And people who use it throughout their entire pregnancy often do so with a particular reason in mind. So I ask people why they're using it, how they find it beneficial. I hear a lot of folks using it for chronic pain, a lot of folks using it for anxiety. Many times people have tried more traditional pharmaceuticals that they feel like they can be open with their doctors about, but they haven't worked very well. So I encourage people to use cannabis not necessarily as a first resort, but to make sure that it's part of what they're thinking about in dealing with their symptoms. And then I usually encourage people to think about ways to, if they're postpartum, reduce exposure to babies in the same way you would smoking. So we actually postpartum have a lot of good skills around this. We know how to talk to people about sober parenting. We know how to talk to people about using alcohol and breastfeeding because we have a sense of the metabolic curve of alcohol and we can tell them, you know, have a drink, breastfeed about 2 hours later. We're starting to have some data similar to that when it comes to cannabis. And the time frame would be more like 4 hours potentially. And we also know how to talk to people if they use cigarettes and are breastfeeding. You know, reduce babies' exposure to smoke. Don't ever smoke around them. I encourage people to have literally a smoking jacket where they go outdoors, they put on something else, and then before they come back in, they remove that outer layer. And that they're aware that off-gassing through your mouth really does happen with cigarettes and with cannabis for about 30 minutes after. And it can sort of change the microenvironment around a baby's face. So I often give people a sense of staying a little bit further away until that first half an hour is over. So there's actually lots of skills we've already developed as healthcare providers, as consumers, to think about how to reduce risk of other substances. And I just encourage people to think about that from a health point of view. I also then encourage people to think about what it looks like for child welfare intersections with them. What is their risk of that? If people are read as a person of color, their risk of intersecting with child welfare is higher. If someone calls me and they're on Medicaid, they are going to come under a different level of scrutiny and surveillance than someone using private insurance. So I try to talk to people about whether or not they disclose their cannabis use and what it might look like to go into a hospital. Most hospitals do some sort of urinalysis upon admission. So, if you're going to go into a hospital facility, you should expect to be drug tested. And if you decline that drug testing, which is totally within your right, expect to have that be a red flag that folks are going to believe then that you are probably using something that you don't want to disclose. And then that really can trigger a conversation about babies, because even though pregnant folks require informed consent to be able to test their bodily fluids, in the vast majority of states in this country, medical personnel can test bodily fluids of babies without parental consent or knowledge. And so I just try to tell people what that might look like if you were approaching that place, because that really can undermine somebody's first experiences of parenting to know that a medical practitioner decided to test their baby and not tell them about it because they were the problem.
And you make a great point of how we do have different considerations in terms of or how we approach counseling for using other substances that are legal, like caffeine and alcohol
yes.
and cigarettes.
Yes. Yes.
And so what that kind of leads me beautifully into understanding a little bit of what happens during breastfeeding and cannabis exposure or usage. And so I had like, I wrote a few things that I a few concepts that I thought were important to explain before to understand the conversation, which was, can you explain the oral bioavailability?
Yeah. So oral bioavailability, that is, babies are exposed to things in breast milk orally. And oral bioavailability, that is a hard word to say, isn't it, altogether, is really just how available is that substance to the baby when they consume it orally through breast milk. So for cannabis, the oral bioavailability is about 1% to 5%, which means that whatever is in the human milk, the baby would be exposed to and able, would metabolize, would actually take on board 1% to 5% of whatever was in the breast milk. So they are, even though they are exposed orally to all of it, they only are able to take up 1% to 5% of it, which is an important thing to realize, because when we think about how much a person might use and then how much shows up in their breast milk, and then the fact that their baby is exposed to 1% to 5% of that, we're starting to get down to pretty small amounts that a baby would be exposed to.
And from the, I did read the study, the paper that you co-wrote, and what you guys found is that in terms of how much shows up in breast milk itself, it was something like 2.5%? That was
the relative infant dose.
Right. So explain relative infant dose now for me, please.
Yeah, so that's the dose that the relationship between the dose the baby would experience relative to the dose that the parent consumes. And we believe generally that a relative infant dose under 10% is usually considered safe. And this was 2.5% was the calculated RID in that paper.
So just like alcohol, that you think, okay, if I'm going to have a glass of wine, I'll have a glass of wine right after I breastfeed, and then that's gonna, you know, stay in my body, my breast milk, my bloodstream. For alcohol, we know it's like about 2 hours.
Right.
What you guys found was then that in terms of cannabis, it was more like 4 hours?
Correct.
And in terms of, so by in 4 hours, it was pretty much all out of the parent system.
Exactly. So for, and again, there were most of the folks in that study used occasionally, and a couple folks used more regularly. And for the people who abstained for 24 hours and had undetectable amounts of THC in their breast milk, the occasional users, they consumed, and by 4 hours after consumption, it was nearly down to undetectable limits again. So it was about a 4 hour metabolic curve, which is about what we would expect, given what we know about the pharmacokinetics of THC metabolism in the bloodstream. Because you said it exactly right. What's happening in the bloodstream is more or less what's happening in the breast milk. There's a little bit of a delay between the two when it comes to cannabis. But like alcohol, the metabolic curve that we are familiar with in the bloodstream should, in fact, and did in that study, in fact, reflect what we saw in the breast milk.
And so similar to alcohol in the risk-benefit analysis, that we're back to really considering whether a person is having a drink here or there, or they have a more chronic usage need relationship for, you know, even alcoholism, right?
Exactly.
In terms of chronic users of cannabis, you found that the levels did stick around for a bit longer.
That's the that's the guess with the two subjects in that study that were probably more chronic users. And in fact, that's one of Dr. Hale's next studies, is he really wants to dig into folks who are using daily or near daily and see what that baseline level might look like. There are some other studies that show that the more often cannabis is used, the longer it takes to clear from the system, that you do sort of build up some of that, both metabolite and THC can exist in adipose tissues and be leached out slowly if you use chronically. So that those are all the guesses, and the data suggests that that's going to be the case, but we can't say that definitively quite yet.
Okay. And so so the numbers of the oral bioavailability of 1 to 5% and having a relative infant dose of 2.5%, the 2.5% would be considering or assuming that, you know, that baby breastfed or drank some of that milk before it left the parent system, right? It's like within those 4 hours or at the peak or somewhere. Is that, am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah, well, that 2.5% relative to the dose that is happening in the parent at the same time. So if you wanted to reduce that number, what that absolute number would be, you would breastfeed after having waited for a number of hours. Yes, you understood that correctly.
And I think it's really important to get those details out in the open, because it's just like, for some reason, this made me think of Lisa Henderson-Jack, that she is a fertility specialist that I've had on the show before. And she's like, you would not understand how many people think they can get pregnant at any point during their cycle. You can only get pregnant during 6 days of your cycle. So
right.
Kind of
right.
Like that same idea of, if we were to think of the baby getting high, quote unquote, that could only happen at a certain time after consumption by the parent, right. And also taking into consideration whether it's an occasional use or a chronic use. Like, I know it's a very complicated conversation, but I think because of that, we need to also consider it a complicated conversation and a nuanced conversation, and context is everything.
Yeah. And, you know, again, I'll come back to this idea. Cannabis is used as medicine by some people. You know, rarely are people using beer or wine as strictly medicine. It might be a coping piece of their life, but there are folks who are using cannabis as medicine. And I would love to see us embrace the nuance that we're able to have about antidepressant use or blood pressure medication use, or, you know, the ways that we can talk people through their medicines through pregnancy and breastfeeding. And that requires a lot of nuance, a lot of individual risk-benefit analysis. That is all really I would love to see us do with cannabis, is to actually start talking about it a little bit more the way we know how to talk about other medications, rather than vilifying its use right out of the gate. I mean, you know, there are so our breast milk actually has endocannabinoids. So the reason exocannabinoids like THC work on our body is we have a system that already uses molecules, cannabinoid molecules, to do all sorts of things. And there are some theories that we know there are endocannabinoids in breast milk. And the idea of babies getting milk drunk, you know, that like totally floppy, eyes roll into the back of their heads look, might be a result of their exposure to endocannabinoids. And I think it's really interesting to think about, we've got this system that we actually really love to watch how it works. And yet if we are using exogenous cannabinoids, it instantly comes with a sense of judgment. And I just wish we could suspend that judgment a little bit and ask a few more questions about how those exocannabinoids are being used and the ways they might be influencing how our endocannabinoids are functioning.
And be more respectful of that person as well and their ability to, you know, their autonomy and ability to take care of themselves and take care of their child in
totally.
The sense, right, in the sense that, you know, I get that people don't like get pregnant or start breastfeeding and then become a chronic daily high cannabis user.
That is exactly right. I love that. Say that again. That is exactly right.
Right.
And we don't expect people with high blood pressure when they become pregnant to all of a sudden not have high blood pressure anymore.
Right. And so these people that are faced with this ha really having to sit down and have a deep conversation about what the risk assessment is for them is because they are probably have a higher usage of cannabis or more chronic usage of cannabis, as you were saying, as medicine, or because it provides something in their life that
Yes.
they need to an extent to function. Like, it's not just, oh, because I want to get high, right? And that's
And even if it's that, I mean, Gabor Maté talks about addiction being rooted in trauma. And if somebody has had trauma in their life, sometimes using cannabis to deal with that trauma and function is the best way that they've learned how to do that. And I wish we could hold them in the space they're in and help them deal with that trauma. Because we know for sure that if we make them a more healed, more improve their well-being, they're going to be able to do that as a parent for their child as well.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And one phrase that really stuck to me in the reading that I did was you had a PDF, and I can't remember which one it was, but it mentioned how breastfeeding can be a protective factor against child abuse and neglect. And so having that conversation of, well, do you in the risk assessment of what is it better to stop breastfeeding or breastfeed while using cannabis? And considering that and having that assumption that if you're using if cannabis, if you're ingesting cannabis then or smoking, I'm trying like the words, the specific words is not coming to me, using that it can be tied to child abuse and neglect, right? If it's detected in by law in the testing for the baby, then it's assumed that it's child abuse and neglect. But this parent is actually trying to breastfeed their child, which is a protective factor against child abuse and neglect. So can you talk a little bit more about what that consideration, that conversation?
It's probably one of the pieces I'm most frustrated about the climate in Colorado right now. We are in a place where the vast majority of hospitals are not encouraging breastfeeding after if somebody either has demonstrated or suspected cannabis use during their prenatal period. That I have heard stories of folks not being given pumps, folks not being offered lactation services. A few hospitals are offering waivers now where you basically say, I understand that I am potentially harming my baby and I'm letting these healthcare providers off the hook. And I thought we were at a place of understanding not even that breastfeeding can be good for everybody's health and well-being and mental well-being. Which is how it protects against child abuse and neglect in the long run. But I thought we were at a place of really understanding the risks of not breastfeeding, the health risks, the financial risks. And I am surprised that we have so quickly moved to an abstinence-only perspective when it comes to cannabis and breastfeeding, and that in fact we're actively preventing people from establishing a breastfeeding relationship because we're concerned about the long-term impacts of cannabis use. I think it's myopic. I think it's reducing breast milk to simply its constituents. And again, it's ignoring the context of what physiologic breastfeeding is between mammals. It's much more than just food. It's a place, it's a relationship, it's a hormonal profile, it's a sense of competency, a sense of purpose, a biologic tie to your offspring, all of which is undermined if breastfeeding doesn't exist. And I never want to ever shame anybody for not breastfeeding. We all have our own journey. And I am speaking to people who desire to breastfeed, want to breastfeed. And right now in Colorado, the system, whether it be lactation folks, policy folks, hospital administrators, nurses, midwives, pediatricians, are really not having any kind of nuance about their conversation around cannabis using folks and breastfeeding. And they're saying things that are ultimately going to reduce people's openness with their providers. I had someone who had used cannabis for chronic pain prior to becoming pregnant. Once she found out she was pregnant, she stopped. She was actually drug tested throughout her pregnancy and tested negative. She and her baby were drug tested at birth. They both tested negative. When she went to her pediatrician, the pediatrician said, "For me to not report you to CPS and know that you are breastfeeding, you must require me to drug test your baby every time you come to the pediatrician, because I don't believe you're not going to go back to those habits." And at this point, this woman had been without these habits for almost a year and had proved that repeatedly to the system. And so then what happened? She did not go back to that pediatrician. It took a while for her to find another pediatrician and get in to see them and feel comfortable talking about her experiences as a new mom. So that kind of punitive, we know the research is super clear that the more punitive healthcare providers, support folks, doulas, anybody supporting, family members, the more punitive we are about substance use during pregnancy and lactation, the more underground people go and the less help they get. So I would encourage the same non-punitive conversation around breastfeeding than I would around pregnancy. And the truth is, the amount of cannabis that babies are exposed to, even if someone is a chronic user, even if there is THC in their breast milk most of the time, is vanishingly small. It's very small. And I really question us shutting down this mammalian physiologic process that has adapted for us to succeed as parents and progeny for this very hypothetical fear that is related to an herb that has actually been used in pregnancy and lactation for 4,000 years. You know, cannabis has been around for as long as humans have been around. It's not a new substance. And somehow we've made it this far. And I'm not saying we shouldn't have concerns and that we should support people who are using in an abusive or an addictive way. But I am deeply concerned at how we're shutting down breastfeeding as a result of our theoretical fears about exposure to cannabis.
Well, and it's a matter of stigma, shame, and bias.
Yeah, completely, 100%.
Because if healthcare providers and the healthcare system had the actual willingness to even try to have a nuanced conversation, right?
Yeah.
Not just get the black and white, and then looked at the evidence that as you are looking at it, like you see the evidence, you read the evidence, and you understand what it means and take away the bias and the stigma and the shame, then maybe the conversation would be completely different.
Yeah.
A more supportive conversation and one that would then benefit the families themselves and encourage breastfeeding, not take that away from them.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, and I do understand the context of our system. Healthcare providers don't have any time for nuanced conversations. You know, pediatricians are generally not trained in breastfeeding. It's not a required part of their medical education. So I understand that I am deeply imbued in the midwifery model of care that has a continuity of care and the ability to create a therapeutic relationship that doesn't always exist in our current maternity pediatric care system. So I do want to make that context really clear that pediatricians have a heck of a lot on their plates when they're trying to see babes in the early days. And the need to just have a test as a way to draw a line in the sand, I can understand the appeal of that.
But that's different than, like, I definitely hear that. I definitely hear that. But that is different from the example that you shared about how this mom was clean for over a year, and then the pediatrician was still falling into more of a power play dynamic of, well, if you don't let me test your baby every time because I don't believe you. And trust really needs to go both ways. How can you trust somebody to be your child's doctor or your doctor if they don't trust you? I mean, clearly that was the best answer of, well, this relationship needs to end and I need to find somebody else because you're not the best doctor for me. That frustrates, just hearing it. I didn't have to, like, just hearing it frustrates me to no end. I'm so sorry.
I know. And, you know, I often don't hear what happens to these folks. Like, I chat with them over the course of a few weeks while they're navigating a part of their story. And then I rarely get to find out, like, how'd they land? What happened? Is she still breastfeeding? That's always my question. Like, was that such a difficult experience that it impacted her breastfeeding relationship? Like, that's my other worry, is that breastfeeding relationships can be really tenuous in the early days and weeks. And they're as emotional as they are how to get the good latch. And that's the other sadness that I see in a lot of folks that I support, is their sense of their ability to parent is being undermined in those very early days. We had a client who really had a terrible in-hospital experience because the providers were pretty judgmental about her cannabis use. And she was investigated by Child Protective Services. And she's about 2 years postpartum now. And she still talks about how her heart races, total PTSD, when anybody drives up her driveway and she hears the gravel, you know, crinkle under their cars, because that sound made her worry every time in those early days that Child Protective Services was going to be at her door and take her baby away. And she, it's her second born, and they've had a really different bonding experience and are still really suffering from the trauma of the fear of investigation in those first few days and weeks. And we're 2 years later. And so that when you ask me, what have I learned about child welfare, that's the other big piece that I would love for folks in my demographic, especially, to understand. An investigation by a child welfare person, simply having somebody suggest that you are not a good enough parent in those early days and weeks of having a baby, really undermines a lot of the physiologic and emotional and psychological processes that make for good long-term parent-baby relationships. And just the threat of investigation, just the threat of judgment, just the threat of child removal can undermine that relationship in a way that I think probably is intergenerational, if I'm really honest. And we shouldn't underestimate the impact of having your parenting questioned and feeling surveilled by the state. They are extraordinarily impactful experiences to have as a new parent. And we often dismiss them in the idea that we're keeping babies safe and that that's just part of the process. And I would argue that they're more impactful than that. And we should be thinking about investigations like that a lot more sparingly than we do.
And it's such a vulnerable time in life, being a new parent, giving birth, being pregnant, right? So on top of this, and it's physiologically, I'm not just saying, you're more vulnerable. No, like physiologically, you are more vulnerable. And to have this added to it, along with your identity change, like it is not only traumatic, it is downright abusive, frankly.
Yeah, Yeah, I agree. And I keep speaking to the fact that my demographic, white middle class ladies like me don't know this because we don't know this. That we our community is not intersecting with child welfare in the same way as Black and Brown communities are. When I talk about this issue with majority Black and Brown folks, it is a radically different conversation because the health risks actually take second to the child welfare risks most of the time in their minds. And they're really looking to navigate that first and mitigate the health risks as need be. When I talk about this with primarily white audiences, I'm often having to really say, no, the risk of child welfare is huge for some communities, even though it's not something that you experience. And that risk that is a risk related to what kind of insurance you might have, or what kind of income you might have, or what kind of race or ethnicity you have. We should be talking about that risk a lot because we can. Those are systemic changes that we can affect. Health risks are something we're going to always be uncovering information about, but we know the systemic risks related to child welfare. But because the majority of folks who are legislating, policing, regulating this are white folks, my experience is white folks are constantly underestimating the child welfare risks. So I appreciate you giving me a chance to talk about this because I have learned that there was so much I didn't know about this part of being a parent, and that this is a huge part of parenting for many communities that don't look like me.
What are some resources to help people navigate the child welfare system? Are there resources to help them with navigating this part? Because I feel like there's, like you were saying, there's plenty of research that we can point them to in terms of the health risks. If you have tons of that research on your website, but in terms of the idea of how do I navigate the child welfare system and what are those considerations? What's the risk there that I need to weigh? Is there a place?
There's not great centralized resources. Folks can always call us at Elephant Circle, no matter where you live. We can sometimes help you put you in touch with somebody who's also experienced what you're experiencing or some legal help. So we are happy to serve as a resource no matter where you are if we can help you. National Advocates for Pregnant Women is a group of lawyers that think a lot about the legal ramifications of how pregnant people navigate the world and talk can really help people navigate child welfare. The Bronx Defenders, they actually are writing and doing a ton of work around bringing to light some of these child welfare issues. And then there's another group, I want to say Movement for Family Power. I'm going to have to maybe get back to you and tell you the exact name so you can put it in your notes. But they are another group that is also working with affected parents to really help people navigate child welfare. What I would say is if you have any worries about child welfare involvement, reach out to somebody sooner rather than later. The initial interactions that a person has with child welfare are absolutely critical to the way the case unfolds. And often those first interactions take the parent off guard. They're not even totally sure they're having them, or they're angry or defensive, or whatever it might be. And in fact, getting to a place of being in your power so that you can have a really positive interaction, as hard as that may sound to those of us who would find that interaction really tricky, that's going to help your case long term.
Yeah, no, thank you so much for all those resources. I'll put them in the show links because definitely it sounds like it's something that is even more nuanced than
Yes.
all the
Well,
conversations
and
that we
so unpredictable. I mean, that's one of the other things I've learned is that Child welfare is rarely a criminal thing. It's rarely in the courts. That's the stuff we hear about, but there's lots of other investigations that happen outside the courts. And unlike the courts, where you have to be Mirandized, somebody needs to have a warrant to come into your house, people are going to tell you what's happening. Child welfare is a very nimble process that can be sometimes hard to predict. And you might not even know what's going on all the time because there isn't the same due process as there is in more criminal proceedings. So it really, I mean, nuanced barely begins to cover it because it really ends up being a case by case conversation.
And I saw on your website they also had a couple of resources to help in risk assessment, and I'm going to mention them and let me know if there's any other ones. There was the Infant Risk Center and Lact Med. Are there any other ones? Those are good,
Yeah,
solid.
the Infant Risk Center. So that's Dr. Hale. And they're the ones who came to Colorado to do the little study that we did in 2018. And he's always going to give you, I mean, that's what the Infant Risk Center does so well, is just give you the parameters, the pharmacokinetic parameters that we know, so that you can make a good analysis for yourself. LactMed is the resource generally populated by the CDC recommendations. And it's becoming a little bit more mainstream in that they are advocating more for abstinence than anything else. But the CDC historically has been had a little bit better conversation about the data. So LactMed can be a good spot.
Great. Heather, is there anything that you wanted to make sure we said that we haven't gotten to yet? And I think we were a bit over, like I was a little bit all over the place, but we covered a lot of ground.
We did. I guess that I would just offer, we all have biases around this topic of perinatal substance use. And I think if you are working with folks and you ever encounter people that are using substances during the perinatal period, check in with your own biases and really root that conversation in compassion for that person and why they are using those substances, and empathy for that person. And I talk a lot about therapeutic relationships. Pregnancy is actually a wonderful time of adaptation. Our bodies are adapting, our psyches are adapting, our spirits are adapting. And in fact, lots of people can come to terms with substance use during pregnancy if they aren't feeling shamed or blamed about it. So I really encourage people to think of what would it look like for me to have a therapeutic relationship with somebody while they're navigating their substance use in pregnancy. And that simple compassion, empathy, and support has the potential to help them reduce that substance use even further. Judgment, shame, punitive responses generally is going to drive people into hiding. It's going to increase trauma responses, and it generally does not improve the substance use during the perinatal period. So, like us birth workers center much of what we do in compassion and empathy, I would say the same thing for this conversation. And really checking your own biases and the things that you think about this, and pushing ourselves to expand the way we view people's use of substances as something that they're not doing to harm their baby, but something that they're doing to cope with their lives. And what would it look like if we address that piece and the harm to the baby would reduce as we help them cope with their lives differently.
That is beautifully said. So wonderful. That's a little too long for a t-shirt. However, thank you so very much, Heather, for this conversation. If
Thank you.
people want to connect with you, ask you questions or follow what you're doing, how can they do that?
Feel free to go to our website, elephantcircle.net. Feel free to email me, heather@elephantcircle.org.
Fantastic. Thank you so, so very much.
Thank you. It's been great.
Mighty Ones. Find the in-depth show notes for this episode at birthful.com, where you can also learn more about me, the show, send me messages, and more. And please, please join us tomorrow, December 26th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time at facebook.com/birthful for a live event with giveaways. This is going to be an ongoing celebration every Thursday through the month of January to celebrate the 5 years of Birthful. This episode was produced by me and made possible by you, my amazing Birthful patrons, and by the wonderful people at Derma E and Ember Wave. Go to dermae.com and use the promo code BIRTHFUL20 to get 20% off your entire purchase. And for $50 off your Ember Wave bracelet, go to EMBRWAVE.com/birthful. The title song for this podcast is Vive Ace by Kevin McLeod, and the sponsorship song is Air Hockey Saloon by Chris Zabriskie. Find them both at freemusicarchive.org. Also, the Birthful podcast is part of the Parents on Demand Network, a network of podcasts focused on parents. Download the free Parents on Demand app on Apple and Android for easy on-the-go listening. Oh, and I was so focused on my conversation with Heather that I forgot to ask her what she had for breakfast. When I followed up, she said that coffee and an apple are her go-to breakfast items most days. I'm Adriana Lozada. Please join me next week when I'll be talking to a mighty parent as they share their amazing story here at the Birthful Podcast. Thanks so very much for listening. This episode is copyright 2019 by Adriana Lozada.